So thank you for having come back after the lunch and in spite of the competition of the weather. I'm going to hear Alfonso Martinez Arias from Cambridge, UK. Development and the Eternal Return. I mean, that's a very nice title. Yeah.
Thank you. Usually after lunch, I suffer an episode of narcolepsy. So if any of you follows that, that's fine by me. What follows is in that spirit of the afterlife, this is a platitude. If you look up what a platitude is, it will tell you it's a trivial or boring statement delivered as if it was important. And that's pretty much what I'm going to do. So if you feel like that at the end, you haven't been told that you haven't been warned. So when I was invited about this to talk about development and regeneration, it was very difficult. Regeneration is not something I think very much about because I don't think we understand development, so why should we understand regeneration? But it's been quite stimulating, and the talk has been evolving as I've been listening to many of you. I think the answer to the two questions posed in the title are very simple from my point of view. I think they are the same mechanisms, but they are not... Sorry, different mechanisms, but same concepts. And I'm not sure what that means, but that's pretty much it. So regeneration actually means, from the Latin, to regenerate, to generate again. This is what it means. Really, if you think about what we've been listening about regeneration, it's not very clear that regeneration has anything to do with generate again, because the product of the regeneration that many of you talked about has nothing to do with the original product, as you've been telling us. And development is, on the other hand, is an unfolding of a process. A lot of what I'm going to say really is part of a sometimes knowing and sometimes unknowing discussion with Denis, as a matter of fact. And a few years ago, he reminded me of a piece that he wrote in which he states this, you see, that to me was very important. Development is a science of recurrence, a science of recurrence, based on the assumption that the same process will happen again and again in each generation, leading to results that we can predict. I thought that was quite interesting, and that's why probably, you know, development is represented by that wheel in which the adult gives rise to the babies again, and this really goes on throughout the animal kingdom. And that's why we represent in textbooks these situations in which the things are going over and over again. And it's very difficult to know or to understand how we go from one of these organisms to another. So to echo what's going on in the other room, which has to do with biblical studies, I would say that it's not very surprising that in the course of the human thinking, you know, you get this repetition, this constant recurrence. You're not going to be able to invent it again. So when God is going to destroy the whole of the earth, it needs to get each of these individuals into the ark, a pair, so that the recurrence can go on. I always said that here the Bible betrays God, because if God is almighty and can do everything, why doesn't he invent the whole thing over again? I think probably what he invented was DNA and let DNA run its course. He liked what he saw, and that's why he has to get to the ark to save everything. But it's not a joke. It's important. It's very difficult to see how these things relate to each other. And I think the reason why during development we get this constant recurrence is because of the germ cells, which really are highly specialized stem cells. In a way, the stem cells of development, and are the basis for this recurrence in which everything can happen over and over again. In a way, it's a way that the embryo has of not only of repair, but actually to regenerate itself in the sense of the original definition. That's not very different from what's going on in your bodies all the time, because although a lot of you have been talking about regeneration in the context of injury, we have to remember that during our lifetime, all our organs and all our tissues are under wear and tear, and that the maintenance of that wear and tear is due to stem cells, which are tissue-specific stem cells, which are maintaining that. This is actually work from a summary of the New York Times of the work of Jonas Friesen, which some of you might know, who used the pulse chase experiments that the Russians and the Americans did with nuclear testing in the 50s to map the turnover of every tissue in the organism. So in a way, it's not very, very difficult. I mean, if you think about every organ, sometimes I do, as an individual organism, which just happens to come together to build a complete organism, I mean, you can see that there are stem cells there, and germ cells are simply the stem cells of the whole organism. There is that similarity. we know a little bit about where the program for the whole organ is escaped, although we don't understand, but as I'll come back later, it's very remarkable, as some of you have observed, that when you regenerate an organ, you can regenerate it de novo. The cells de-differentiate and they seem to keep a memory of what they want to build later, and this is something that I think is quite important and we don't understand. But we've gone beyond the biblical age, and we know that this constant recurrence is sort of contrasted with evolution. And again, to finish the sentence of Denis, evolution relies on the exact opposite premises. It is, by definition, a linear process where from recurrence is impossible. So he's contrasting this recurrence of development with the non-recurrence of evolution. And really, one of the things that you have to do if you think about development is to match these two situations. There is a paradox if you think about that. We know that evolution works because there is DNA, there is mutation, there is selection, and this leads to these very remarkable changes that can allow whales to evolve from land-made animals, for land-living animals. So it is that in the course of evolution, in the many generations, in the very large time scale, that recurrence gives rise to changes because the cells accumulate mutations. Selection has on those mutations to generate new forms. So we are starting to see a little gap on this idea that development is simply recurrence. There is another element, depending on the time scale that you look at, but over the large time scale, it might be different. Here is another similarity with regeneration, if you wish, because it turns out this is a work that I think is still rather controversial, but sort of tries to link the propensity of acquiring tumors in a particular tissue to the turnover of that tissue, to the number of replications that tissue acquires. And tissues that have very large turnover rates, very small turnover rates, or that turnover very fast, have a much higher probability, certainly of accumulating mutations, and therefore of sometimes hitting tumors. In fact, work from the laboratory of Christopher Walsh in Harvard is showing now, and they are using it to map the brain, that basically we get mutations at every cell division from the zygote, and that therefore you are a barcoded animal. We don't need to do CRISPR-Cas on humans because we've been CRISPRed by ourselves. And this is very interesting because some of those mutations can have functional situations, and that's what he and his lab use in the terms of neural degeneration. So it's not surprising, we all know basic biology, that the more a cell, the system is not, the mechanism of replication is not perfect, and the more you replicate, the bigger is the chance to escape the surveillance that a lot of the things are. And here you have the situation that this is from the work of Fogelstein, and it's that if you look at, in terms of tumors, no, the percentage of driver mutations that are hereditary or environmental, the replicative is much more higher. So, you know, I think I could finish the talk here. I promised Denis that I would be brief, but I'm going to expand a little bit. Basically, what we say is in biology, there is no free lunch. I mean, you know, you cannot just have the same thing over and over, and there is no eternal return, because actually, in the evolution time scale, development is non-recurrent. And this is because of the accumulation of mutations. I should point out that the idea of the eternal return is a very philosophical idea, that some philosopher, Mircea Eliade, Nietzsche, but in the physics, it was Ludwig Boltzmann that introduces with the ideas that developed from a statistical mechanics about irreversibility, and they really haven't solved it. But in biology, I think if you think about it, it's just there is no way back. We are always going to be moving forward, and development is going to be moving forward. So these are, as I see from this after-lunch high-level view, similarities between development and regeneration, that particularly that they both are susceptible to mutations, that those mutations can be selected for, in one case, generate variability, although we don't know a lot of aborted variability that occurs, and that's why always in the evolutionary trees there is a lot of branches that don't develop. And you know, there is this theme of recurrence that is happening in every one of your organs also. But, as I like to say, I think that embryos, and that's the favorite organism of a developmental biologist, do not just inherit DNA. I think we make a big deal about the genes that we inherit as embryos or embryos or are passed from generation to generation, but they also inherit programs of gene expression. I like to call them programs of gene expression, which we understand very little about. Timers, it's interesting when you look, embryos develop, they are very synchronized, and orderly events. And that's as important, and I hope you'll see what I mean by that. And one of the manifestations of that, this is a 20th century representation of a very set of plates by Ernst Haeckel in the 19th century, which basically shows a range of embryos which are at a certain stage of development are very much like each other. Why is this important? It is because if you look at the zygotes of many different embryos, particularly when they start cleaving and generating multiple cells, they all look very different from each other. Usually it tends to be a layer of cells, a single layer of cells, that has to be transformed into a three-dimensional object. And that happens through the process of gastrulation. And the process of gastrulation is very diverse. It happens in very different ways in very different animals. Now, there is something interesting that echoes what Katharina Becker said yesterday. You look at all these things, and they all use BMP, they all use WIN, they all use NODL, they have the same genes. How are those differences emerging? I think this is something that we don't think enough. We seem to be interested in looking for what is different rather than understanding how come something that is the same everywhere all the time, it gives rise to different things. Gastrulation is really the magic of development. This is a very famous movie by a famous developmental biologist, Ray Keller, and that's what happens. That's a frog embryo. And you can see at this time the embryo is just a ball of cells and it has a little dimple there that is going to be the place where the cells are going to invaginate and generate this three-dimensional structure. And at the end of gastrulation, what happens is that something that we call the body plan sort of emerges. That body plan is very, very conserved. Although the embryos gastrulate, all embryos, each embryo gastrulate its own way, sometimes the output is very, very similar, and that's what it says here. In a way, in some ways, it's what Haeckel said. This is a little bit more detailed. Building on a combination of the programs that I've shown that some of you might have recognized and the Hawks, and this set of similarities, Denis de Boulle in 1994, proposed his view of development and this conservation of this state, which is called the phylotypic stage, in the terms of the hourglass model. And what he proposed is that for some reason, which I would say that's still unclear, although you start all the different embryos have different starting boundary and geometrical conditions and are going to end up being very different, all these animals are going to become much more diverse morphologically and phenotypically than they are at this stage, they go through some kind of bottleneck in which they all seem to be the same. And the product is sort of this elongated structure, which is also segmented with an anteroposterior polarity. And in the recent years, people have been, in my view, forcing a little bit data from genomics, trying to claim that what's happening at this sort of bottleneck of the hourglass is that the genes that are expressed in that period are much more conserved than the genes that are expressed either before or after. I don't know very much about data juggling. I suspect that there is a lot of that going on here. And while this is true, I'm not sure particularly about the early one that is the case. Now, if you think about embryos of any species, leaving mammals for a moment, just before gastrulation, what you will imagine is a very large number of cells distributed in different geometries that now are going to undergo this choreography, out of which is going to come the body plan. In the case of the vertebrates, the chordate body plan. But there is a point about mammalian embryos, which is there staring at us, and I've rarely seen it made in public, or in private, and is that, you know, a frog embryo has on the order of what, tens of thousands of cells, a chicken has tens of thousands of cells just before gastrulation, a mammalian embryo has about 400. Now that's not enough to generate all the richness of tissues and organs that it has. The mammalian embryo does something very unique. It generates the polarity, the axis, the different cell types, at the same time that gastrulates, the cells are dividing and all that emerges. That is a very remarkable feature. But that really removes any extrinsic cause that might set up the polarity during the process of gastrulation. You can see here this process on a recent movie from Janilia Farm, which from Kate McDowell and Philip Keller, and it's quite nice. I think it's a first step at a very difficult problem, but they were able to track the early events in the development around gastrulation and during gastrulation in the mouse embryo, and track, as I said, this is a first order approximation problem of the different embryos. Axes are very important in order to organize an embryo or an organism of any kind. And in the case of the mammals, the axes are introduced by tissues that are not going to form part of the embryo. Therefore, they are called extraembryonic tissues, which are the primitive endoderm and the trophoectoderm. And I'm sure that Magda will give you a lot of detail and interesting observations on this and on how to understand what these interactions are. But this is the way a mammalian embryo gets its bearings, as it were, from interactions between the embryonic tissue and the extraembryonic tissue. The extraembryonic tissue, as I presume she will also remind us, is derived also from the zygote. So that's quite important. These extraembryonic tissues are only extraembryonic in the sense of what they will contribute later, but they are derived from the zygote. However, something I did say at the beginning, that embryos do not just inherit DNA or genes, that they also inherit programs of gene expression, timers, orderly events. And of course, embryos like the mammalian embryos derived from embryos in which the axial organization is not derived from extraembryonic tissues. So you might ask the question, is there any memory in the embryonic cells of events that allow it to organize themselves in a space without the aid of any extraembryonic tissue? This is something that we've been studying for the last few years by taking mouse embryonic stem cells and under very precise culture conditions and numbers, we've been putting them in culture and looking at what they can do in the absence of extraembryonic tissues. And we were very surprised from the beginning to see that when we put the cells, they come together, they form a little blob, and then this is two different lines bearing reporters. One is SOC17, which is an endodermal gene, that's brachyury. So what you can see is that these things, much to our amazement, they sort of organize themselves with some polarity and simple focus. And if we let them develop later, and this is work that we did particularly in collaboration with Denis again, as I said, this is part of an ongoing conversation, sometimes conscious, sometimes unconscious. These things, you know, this started with about 200 cells in the dish. And not only this is elongating, we now know that this is neural crest coming out when it touches the substrate. These are the famed Hox genes that they are implemented. These programs are implemented temporally and are also implemented spatially. So these things are highly reproducible. So you can see, I mean, that's simply to get a little bit of structure into these elongating structures. And here you see it's totally recurrent. That is to say, this is the ideal development. It would be an interesting system to study in the long term, whether these things sort of mutate and change as you expect over a bigger time scale. But what this certainly does is give us an opportunity to study in great detail these early events and how access can appear de novo. Over the last few months, we've been collaborating with Alexander van Oudenaarden, who has a technique which allows us, or allows them, to take an object, an embryo of any denomination, cut it into thin slices, do RNA-seq, which means that you can get now a very good representation of the activity of the whole genome in different regions of the organism. In this case, and I'm not claiming that this contraptions that we create are organisms, although you might think that they are, except there are some that are never going to take over the Earth, but they are clearly showing features of organisms. So we were able to get a very complete account of the gene expression along the anteroposterior axis of these contraptions. And here you have five taken at random, the genes organized, clustered with algorithms that allows us to see genes that are expressed anteriorly, posteriorly, in the middle. You can see that the reproducibility morphologically that I have shown you is actually reproduced in terms of the molecular detail. So these programs are very, very entrained in a very big manner. Now, something intriguing about, and we've compared this with the embryo, again, work that we, Leonardo Beccari and Naomi Morris, did with Denis and me, and it's very remarkable how close they resemble embryos in terms of gene expression, in terms both of the temporal sequence and in terms of the spatial organization, which we now has been enriched with this. But they are not embryos for many reasons. Also, I should say they lack the brain, and I'll be happy to come back to that in the questions. They don't have a brain, and by brain I mean the brain, just the brain, forebrain, midbrain, hindbrain. because what this has shown us is that they have a lot of anterior structures, progenitors that in the course of development would give rise to elements of your face, and they are there. What's lacking is the brain. Now, what is important is that when you look at them carefully, and this is something that we've been discussing for a while, and it's an important point, not only they don't look like embryos because they don't look like embryos, but they lack morphogenesis. They lack morphogenesis. They don't have. So we get this very beautiful layout. The molecular body plan, as one would like, the gene regulatory network seem to be acting, but the cells are not executing some other program. And that's quite important. We like to focus on the things that are different, because only when you look at the details of the things that are different, you can sort of contrast and compare the reality with the thing. And what we like to know, I mean, I think I would be very surprised if an embryo would come out of here, because we are doing something. But this allows us to see what is missing and therefore learn something about the embryos. And I think this dissociation of the molecular body plan from the morphogenetic plan is also something interesting to which I will come back at the end. Now, I did say that maybe this is revealing some kind of very basic organization that exists in the cells that can execute in vitro, and that by removing the extraembryonic tissues, we are revealing that. So we can do another reverse experiment, and the first one had been done by Jeremy Green many years ago, in which he took animal caps from a Sinopus embryo. He mixed them in very different ways, put them on a plate, applied activin, and you can see that they get these things, which are very similar to what I think they could be called exogastrally, but I think they are a little bit more than that, although at that time he wasn't looking at that. But they do look very remarkable, like the kinds of things that I've been showing. We collaborate a lot with Ben Steventon in the lab, and somebody I was working with both of us, because Trivedi decided, moved by these observations, decided to do an experiment and see what happened if, as he put it, tried to get gastroloids from the fish. And in that case, what he did is took the cells from the sort of top of the fish as he's developing, played them under certain culture conditions, and you can see that initially the cells spread over the plate, then they bolt up, they rise, and if you wait a little bit longer, I think you can see what they do. They start elongating. They're elongating with a very, very clear polarity. So we've looked at gene expression in these contraptions. This is actually what these things look, which they like to call pescoids. You seem to need a commercial name these days to go somewhere with things. And we call them gastroloids, so there is no problem. But I hope you can see the similarity in the execution of these programs. That in both cases, what we have done is to remove the mechanical constraints that are holding the cells. And this raises the possibility that maybe the differences, the morphological differences between species, might not arise simply from the genetic blueprints of the body plan, from different morphogenetic sort of constraints that exist, added onto what would be a conserved basic genetic blueprint. So, you know, this is really what a lot of these things show. We've recently been able to make gastroloids from human cells, which show, again, the same kind of default pathway. And I find intriguing, and this is really, I told you, it would be a platitude and more a matter for discussion later on in this party that Alain has promised us, because I don't want to delay the proceedings. This is an ascidian during development, and you can recognize, again, this shape, that once you remove things from mechanical constraints, it keeps on appearing all the time. In the discussions about the hourglass, which I haven't been privy to, and really it's something that I've known about by teaching developmental biology, but I haven't had to think about this until confronted with these observations from these things that we built in the plate. You know, the origin of the of this phylotypic stage is not clear, but I would suggest that the origin lies on something much more ancient and much more that this is reflecting a very basic body plan, which contains already the seeds for all the gene expression that define the phylotypic stage. And that gastrulation is a way of removing all these mechanical constraints from the embryo and revealing that very basic body plan on which evolution works, making variations on a very overarching theme. This is also the case in the case of regeneration. And I'm going to show you something which, you know, these days one of the very fancy and very sort of words everywhere is these organoids, and people tell you that they are making organoids of this or that or the other. Here you have, there is six organoids, and each of them is associated with a particular tissue. Could you tell me which one? There is a liver organoid there is an intestinal organoid there is a pancreas organoid, there is a brain organoid. Could you tell me which one is which?
It's a nanoparticle.
I think that there is, There is a very interesting thing here, because again, once you take these things, so these cells, when you look at these cells, they are very close in terms of gene expression to the tissues that they are trying to represent, but morphologically, they are a mess. They don't, in fact, there is a big variability morphologically, and when I talk to these people, they do tell me these things, that in terms of gene expression, they are very similar. Here is the answer to all of them. Now, none of them looks like what they should do. In fact, they all look very much like each other. And yet, it is like what I was talking to you about the gastrolytes. Once you remove the mechanical constraints, you are in a situation where you are revealing some very basic organization, in this case, this epithelia, which bud in different ways, which create. So the shape, the morphogenesis, must come from somewhere else. So I would say that's a brain, by the way, in case you haven't. So there might be something missing here. There is something that we are missing about the interactions. We cannot assume that gene regulatory networks are able of creating morphogenesis. I think this is obvious from experiments that we are trying to do, but also the organoid field is telling you that people are more interested in selling their little organ than in asking the questions that you say. By the way, they all use Wnt, they all use BMP, and they all use Notch. Okay? So how does that difference appear? So it was with great interest, I've known for many years what I'm going to show you about, but it's really, clearly there was someone who all of you know, who almost 60, 70 years ago had a huge foresight about many things. And I think you know him for several reasons, but not for the one I'm going to tell you about, and it's Alan Turing. And in this paper, which is not what many people make up, the Turing paper is really a proof of principle. He doesn't care if nature does what he says it can happen. It's a proof of principle because he says this is possible, this would be a way of doing that. But notice that he makes a very interesting remark. He says that a biological system consists of two parts, the mechanical and the chemical. He is remarkably foresight. I mean, this is in the 50s. And he actually says that the combination of the two is very, very complicated. So as a very reasonable man, he says, if I want to deal with this practically and formally, and that's what he wants to do, I have to treat them separately. And I'm going to deal here with the easy, which was the chemical. And that would give rise to all this fever about Turing, for which I personally believe that there is no evidence in vivo. Yet. But it's interesting that what he conceives as a formal trick to try to understand development, to separate the two, it might be going on during the development and the regeneration of an organ. And we don't understand, I think, one of the things that we have at the moment to think, and I think this is not just, I think there is a mechanical, there is a geometrical shape that arises in all this and extends to the invertebrates too. This elongation, this kind of elongated shape which keeps on appearing in many different ways. And the same way that we are seeing some default processes going on at gastrulation, this sort of elongation might also reflect some very basic things. Somebody asked me once, what's more difficult, to elongate or to fold? I had never thought about this. But actually, if you ask to a mechanical person something, to fold is much more complicated to elongate. So we might be looking here at some very basic plan that is very important and of course encompasses the phylogenetic state. So although we still don't understand a lot of features of gene regulation, if we want to link those processes of gene regulation to the three-dimensional organization of organs and tissues, we are going to have to think very much about this gap, which I think these experiments, some inadverted and some adverted, are showing. So thank you for the meeting, for the opportunity to think about these things, and I look forward to your questions and discussions, now or later. This is just to thank everybody that has, and particularly, as I said, this is the people in the lab that have been helping with this. Very fun collaboration over the last, sometimes I say last year, and they remind me that it's been going on for 3 or 4 years now, and over the last year, the group of Alexander van Oudenaarde in Utrecht, who have been helping us with some of these genomic studies. Thank you very much.